Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be speaking to a Dubliner who has found himself in Germany at the European Space Agency's Astronaut Center, where he is working on building a replica of the moon. We'll be finding out why in a few minutes' time. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of those comments at the end of the podcast. We start off the show reflecting on the week's science news, and we're joined by Dr. Susan Kelleher from the School of Chemical Sciences in Dublin City University, and Dr. Shane Bergen, Fellow of the American Physical Society, and lecturer and associate professor at UCD. Shane, congratulations. It is of great excitement that we learned that you have been awarded the Fellowship of the American Physical Society. And so I had a look at who else is in this list, right? So there's six Irish people in the history of the society that actually have gotten this recognition. They are Sheila Rowan, amazing, significant figure in understanding gravitational wave. Colm Caulfield, recognized for his research in fluid dynamics, really important stuff. David Rice, work spans various areas of condensed matter physics, like a huge contribution to theoretical and experimental domains when it comes to physics. And then Ronald Redmer, who did a lot of work in plasma physics. What did you do?
Oh, well, firstly, thank you, Jonathan. That's fantastic.
What a way to congratulate someone with just a tiny bit of sincerity, which never comes from me, as you know. Immensely huge recognition and wonderful, well done. But sorry, yes.
Thank you. And I'm really pleased to say I got it for public engagement work. So effectively for doing shows like this and other forms of science communication that I love doing. So in many ways, Jonathan, we can share this award.
That's stop. I knew you were going to say that, and it's absolutely not true. Shane does this, but he also does so many other things, podcast outreach, understanding why we should communicate better, and writing letters to the Irish Times every flipping week, talking about why we should better ourselves by funding research and thinking more carefully about how we educate the world. So congratulations, Shane. That's phenomenal. I'm really, really proud of you as a friend and as a colleague. Susan, what have you done this week? You're not a fellow of anything, are you? You weren't made a fellow of anything, were you?
No, not yet.
That's all right.
I have to do more of this show.
Next week.
How many is it? Do 500 and get a fellowship.
That's about it. Exactly.
Right, let's have a look at the week's science news, shall we? Shane, big story is the Europa Clipper has finally gotten underway.
Yeah, we're about to. It's going on Monday. So it was delayed due to one of the many hurricanes that has unfortunately swept through Florida recently. And this is a $5 billion mission. So it's understandable that they delay it because it's at its most dangerous when these things are taking off. Even though we've been doing this since the 50s, sending rockets into space, it still is quite a high risk scenario. The NASA mission is going to Europa. It's kind of like reverse colonialism in the space age. So the Americans are going to Europe, and they are going to the Europa moon, which is a moon of Jupiter, one of many. And it's covered in water. And it's thought that it's twice the volume of water on this moon as there is on all of the water on Earth. And that's incredible. It has a frosty shell. It's about 20 kilometers thick of frozen water. But beneath that frosty exterior lies an ocean that's reckoned to be about 130 kilometers deep. And so they're sending this massive spacecraft to orbit the moon. And it's going to do many sweeps of the moon. And every time it's going to scour the surface for signs or fingerprints of organic molecules. And it's literally going to sniff the gases that are extruded from the moon's surface to try and see if there are the ingredients there for life. This is not a mission to see, was there life on Europa? This is a mission to see, is there life on Europa? And it is incredible. And it's also incredible to think that there could be liquid water so far away from the sun. We're in the Goldilocks position here between Mars and Venus. We're perfect for having liquid water. But one mightn't think that it would be ideal to have or good conditions to have liquid water so far out at Jupiter. And the reason is because of the massive forces that Jupiter sort of exerts on this moon. So it's a weird high intensity radiation scenario, and we're sending a spacecraft out into the middle of it.
I think it's really, really cool. Will it be sampling molecules from the atmosphere of Europa?
Yeah, so that's what I meant by sniff. So there's a lot of sophisticated detectors on it, but one of them would be something, I suppose, akin to like a mass spectrometer, something Susan's probably familiar with from her work. This is an apparatus that can literally inhale molecules, take them in, and it's able to do a chemical analysis to tell what the molecules are. So we could tell whether they're complex organic molecules, which would be the key ingredients for life.
What's really interesting is, you know, despite the number of missions that we have sent to Mars and been successful with, this is probably our most promising attempt to find life yet. And it's quite exciting. How are they going to protect the spacecraft from the immense amount of radiation?
Yeah, this is incredible. So every flyby of the spacecraft will have the dose that's equivalent to 1 million chest x-rays of radiation. So whilst there's nothing living on it, that type of radiation can fry electronics. So they built what's called a Faraday cage out of aluminium, which basically you can put the electronics within it, and it's protected as much as is possible from the harmful radiation that's given off by Jupiter.
Very cool. And presumably it'll take a long time to get there, but we'll follow it. Hopefully we'll see the launch on Monday. We'll see where it all heads. Susan, our second story has to do with fungi.
Yes. So I work with a lot of mammalian and bacterial cells to understand how they respond to really bumpy surfaces. And they really do respond very differently. So, for example, stem cells will differentiate into different cell types depending on how stiff or bumpy a surface is on which they're growing. And in my lab, for example, yeah, I know. I love the way
that's very cool. I didn't realize that. I thought it was all chemical, but actually physical, the surface of something will actually...
There's a whole branch of science that we're keen on over here in DCU. I work with bacteria cells, and we look at how bacteria cells interact with bumpy surfaces and actually creating surfaces that have particular bumps and spikes, depending on how big the spikes are or stiff the spikes are or how far apart they are, they will kill bacteria. So no chemistry. So you can kill antibiotic resistant bacteria by basically impaling them or spiking them to death. So I was really interested when I saw this story, because this is around how fungi interact with surfaces. And it's published in the journal Fungal Ecology. And it's carried out by, the work was carried out by a team of Japanese researchers. They studied how the fungi respond to surfaces with different patterns on them. Now, the surfaces that I work with are on the nanoscale, so the nano or micron scale shapes that we're interested in. But this work looked at fungal interactions with centimeter-sized shapes. So fungi, they grow in very different way to cells. What they do is they produce spores, as we know, and those spores then travel to different places. They grow and they remain connected to each other by this mycelium, this sort of these spidery long white threads. Anyone who's a keen gardener, you might see this when you dig up the white threads. If you've got decent soil that's well aerated and full of nutrients, you'll see this these threads around the roots of plants and that's supporting plant growth. But what the researchers did is they set up the surfaces with wooden blocks in a circle or in an X shape. And they introduced them to wood decaying fungi who would target these wooden blocks.
Yeah.
And they found that instead of just growing out in an outwardly direction from where they were placed, the fungi actually headed to the different blocks. And then they spread out their mycelium, connecting the different blocks. So in a circle, you have this sort of fungal, basically clumps of fungi growing with the mycelium connecting between all these different dots in the circle. And in the X, they head towards the different blocks in the X and they create this pattern of an X with the gaps
between. You say they head towards them, but
mycelium.
They sort of grow in the direction of, I mean, they're not moving around, are they? Or are they?
No, they don't. They're not moving around, but they're clinging to and binding to and growing on those blocks. And the mycelium is connecting all the different blocks and all the different fungal clumps that are growing on the wooden blocks. So the areas between the blocks are free of mycelium and there's no spores landing there. The spores are growing on the actual blocks and they're being connected connected through the mycelium along the pattern of the block, like a pattern recognition.
It almost sounds like something conscious, but obviously we don't want to go down that route, but it
Sorry, that's really important because the paper goes on to talk about the potential super intelligence of fungi. We know that that's not what's happening. There's no neural network of, you know, super genius fungi that's been connected. But there is a pattern recognition. And we see that also with, you know, biofilm formation and kind of quorum sensing with bacteria. So it's just the way that they grow and the manner in which they grow. But it's quite impressive, this large scale connectivity and the patterns that they're making.
And how it's evolved to sort of change its behavior, inverted commas, due to stimulus response. Very cool.
Based on the structure. And I mean, it's fascinating because I don't think it's been seen before for fungi. So the fact that people are starting to understand that they'll also do this pattern recognition and grow differently in different structures is really interesting.
Our third story, Shane, has to do with riding a bike and how we remember how to ride a bike.
Yeah. So when it comes to memories, when we think of like declarative memories, if I were to ask you, what did you have for your lunch today? Or who was your teacher when you started primary school? You're going to recall, right? And you're going to refer to what's called your medial temporal lobe to recall those memories. Now, it's understood that we keep those long-term memories in a very separate part of our brain to where we keep basically the running monologue of what's happening now. I'm in this instant. And we know these are different because when people's medial temporal lobes are damaged, they don't have long-term memory. So this study looks at where we store or where long-term skill memories and motor skill memories are kept in the brain. And it turns out they're kept in an entirely different area. And we sort of known this all along because when people do have damage to the long-term memory, they're still able to carry out functions and to do things with their hands and have learned skills that they've not forgotten. And this study has discovered that those long-term skill memories, things like how we ride a bike or how we might sew or do particular tasks, they're kept in what's called the cerebellum, which is another area of the brain. And much like all of these studies, they can only know these things when they recruit very generous volunteers who have damage to those areas of their brain. So in this study, they would have looked at data sets where people had damage to their cerebellum. I'm very glad to say nobody was damaged for a study. They just looked at old data sets that were really messy, and they were able to apply new levels of analysis to determine that it is this cerebellum that is responsible for where we keep these long-term motor skills in our brain. And I think that's incredible. The brain must be one of the spots in science that we still are so in the dark. Yeah. There's so much for us to learn. I'm always incredibly skeptical when I hear people talking about things that are brain connected because there's so much that is unknown. But the stuff that people are doing is absolutely remarkable. And this is another example of it.
Yeah, very cool. And I suppose when you think about it, it makes sense to store those things in different parts of the brain. But, you know, even figuring out, we had Thomas Ryan on the program not too long ago, who did a lot of work in memory in Trinity College Dublin. It's really interesting to try and figure out what is going on. How are we depositing and recalling these memories day to day? Fascinating stuff. Our final story, quickly, Susan, has to do with smells.
Yeah. So when we smell, it's generally believed that we take in all that information in one like foul swoop. And even if there's different smells, we're not very good at actually distinguishing between them. We are, however, say with colours, and our eyes can quickly figure out what, you know, two different colours are. So the baseline was that we could tell a smell, two different smells apart, if they were 0.6 of a second apart. That's kind of the threshold or the resolution our nose had. But work published this week in Nature Human Behaviour shows that it's actually way faster than we thought it was. So they set people up with two compartments in one chamber, and one of the compartments had the smell of flowers and one of the compartments had the smell of apples. And they connected one of the compartments to one nostril and the other compartment to another nostril of different participants, right? So we have 229 people hooked up to quite a funny looking machine where there's a little valve that can release the different smells at different times.
I would have loved doing that. That sounds like my day. That's the sort of thing I would love to do with my day is have a tube stuck up my nose and have little valves and it give me different smells.
The clever thing here is that the tubes were different lengths. So actually there was a slight difference in the time that it took for the smells to get to the noses, so to the different nostrils. And then they they basically released the different smells at different times and said, you know, can you tell the difference between these? And ultimately what they found is that people are able to tell the difference between them down to milliseconds. So they were way, way, way faster, about 10 or 15 times faster than they originally thought. They also did it with lemon and onion smells, and they're able to tell them apart better. And then they also took the people who were really good at differentiating these smells in this really fast time, and they got them to do it even faster, and they got them down to like 40 to 80 milliseconds. They were actually able to see, you know, smell the difference between those two things and the order of them which they came to their noses. So I, you know,
why do we care how fast I can smell something?
Well, I think it's just about how the body works, right? I mean, I don't know if there's any massive, maybe there is in sensing, you know, sensing applications, maybe around, you know, small percentages of, you know, toxic gases nearby. If there's a release of methane and you want to know that in a hurry, maybe something like that. I mean, they don't actually go into too much of that. It's more about the, did you know that we actually don't know that much about how the nose works, and look at this.
No, and we did a feature on how the nose smells, and we interviewed this guy, and he was a real maverick, and he was basically saying that how we smell things is actually about the frequency at which the molecules vibrate, and not the shape of the molecule as it connects into our receptor. And it was like, we got all these emails saying, you're out of your mind. I didn't realize it was so controversial until we started getting these emails in. So it's a fascinating area. Dr. Susan Kelleher from DCU, from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks so much for joining us. Now, last month, the European Space Agency opened its Lunar Analog Facility. The purpose of this 700 square meter testbed is to faithfully recreate the conditions that astronauts will face on the lunar surface. The lighting, the soil, and even the gravity could mimic that of the moon. And one of the scientists who'll be carrying out the research in this facility is science officer at the European Space Agency and Irishman, Aidan Cowley. He joins me now. Aidan, welcome to the programme. How did a Dubliner end up in the European Space Agency creating fake moons?
That's a really good question. So it took me a while to get here, I have to say, but I'm very happy that I ended up working in this job. Basically, over the years, when I was growing up, I was always inspired by space. It was always a big question, a big thing that motivated me in terms of my career direction. I ended up doing a degree in computer programming, and then a master's in electronics, and eventually a PhD in materials. And always asking the question is, how could I use this to actually end up, you know, doing something in the area of space? And then it was probably during my time in my PhD that I realized there's actually a big connection between the world of materials and the world of space. It wasn't very clear to me before that. And then I began to look into opportunities initially with NASA, but then eventually I realized also that we have a European Space Agency. By chance and luck, there was an opportunity opening up at the facility here at the Astronaut Center in Cologne, where I'm based and where the Luna facility is based. And I applied for this in 2014 and was initially recruited as a research fellow. But then they decided to keep me around, maybe permanent staff there on 2017. So I've been here ever since, as you say, making fake moons for ESA. Yeah.
Oh, very cool. And, you know, to be working, you know, in the Astronaut Center, it must be very exciting. Talk to me a little bit about this Luna analog facility. What exactly is it?
Sure, absolutely. So the Astronaut Center, it's a really interesting place to work. It's primarily the training center for European Astronaut Corps and also for international partners. And because we do so much focus on training here, we look to the future. We look at what's happening next in terms of exploration. And the next logical destination is the moon. So we decided that if we want to prepare for lunar exploration, we need to develop a training facility to help us do so, because we hope to have Europeans on the moon the next decade or so. So that was the original idea behind this, to create a new training facility to augment the existing training facilities that we have here at the Astronaut Center. But it's not just that. It can also do a lot of other things. We can also use this lunar facility to test new technologies, to develop new concepts for operating on the lunar surface, and basically give us more confidence in our capabilities to conduct lunar exploration missions in the future.
How do you go about recreating the conditions on the moon?
So there's certain things you have to accept that would be fundamentally impossible to recreate 100% faithfully. So we made a couple of trade-offs early in the design of the Luna facility. The big one is, people always ask us, is it a vacuum facility? It's not, where we actually operate at ambient atmosphere. But other areas we tried to stay as faithful as we could. So one of the big key features of the facility is the lunar soil, or the regolith, as we call it. So we have approximately 700 tons of lunar soil analog material here. And this is faithfully recreated to be as close as we can make to the kind of the mare regions of the moon, the dark regions of the moon. And this was a very unique selling point at the facility. So when you come there, you see this big sand pit, so to speak, but it's all accurate geologically to what you would expect to find on the moon. Other things we try to recreate are the illumination conditions. So we can actually recreate polar and equatorial lighting conditions. These are the two kind of locations that we expect missions to be conducted at in the future. And then we will also be
understand why you would build, you know, these dust environments. We've actually done a lot on space dust or moon dust on the program. So I understand how tricky it is to recreate and how expensive it is to make. So it's impressive that you've got so much of it over there, considering the cost of reproducing it. But in terms of lighting conditions, why would you bother recreating the lighting conditions of the moon?
It's a good question. One of the big issues is that we're used to, during the Apollo times, like most of the missions were around the equatorial belt of the moon. And this means that they had good sunlight conditions. Mostly the sun was in high angles in the sun. But when we're looking at exploring places like the polar regions of the moon, in those locations, the sun's going to be at a much, much lower angle on the horizon. And this creates a very unique lighting situation. You can get very stark, very strong shadows being cast by things like boulders, by things like landers, by even astronauts themselves. And here on Earth, you know, it's a very difficult phenomenon to recreate 100% because we're so used to shadows while being dark. They tend to be a little bit diffuse. There can be specular lighting, secondary lighting, and so forth. On the moon, this may not be the case, and you may have very, very strong, very, very dark shadows. And this creates an operational challenge because, you know, if you're an astronaut and you have to step into a region as dark, if you don't have a light or something like that, this could be a real hazard. You're walking into essentially a pitch black room with no visibility. And this is one of the things that we want to try recreate so we can understand the limitations of operating in an environment where the shadows are quite strong and quite long and originating from a low sun angle, you know?
I mean, sure, but not to be that guy, why not just bring a torch?
Yeah, it's fair. And that's one of the things we're going to do. But
is it fair? Is that really? I mean, why wouldn't you bring a torch?
It's absolutely fair to bring a torch. And like all the EVA suits will have camera, will have lighting systems built into them. But even still, like there's a lot of operational aspects to understand. Not every part of the vehicle, for example, could be perfectly illuminated. There'll be things like boulders and so forth that can still throw shadow. Even things like, you know, navigation in this kind of environment can confuse a lot of navigation systems. So, for example, right. Robotics on a perfectly illuminated street or a perfectly illuminated moonscape, it's not so difficult for them perhaps to move around. But where there's shadows that are extremely dark, this can really confuse a lot of the navigation algorithms and so forth. So it has a lot of interesting use cases for things like that. And this is what we're hoping to replicate there.
That's so cool, because I guess I had never really thought about shadows being different on the moon. But of course, as you're saying, if there's no other natural light to reflect into these spaces, they're essentially pitch black.
Yes, exactly. And also here on Earth, we have the atmosphere, which diffracts a little bit the light. So you get like a kind of diffuse, you never get like a black line shadow. You get like a little bit of a fuzzy kind of shadow interface area. This is not really the case that you would find on the moon because there's no atmosphere to attenuate or diffract the light. So you get very, very, very stark relief of light and dark. Yeah.
Right. So typically when astronauts prepare for low gravity environments, they do this In a couple of ways, but most usually in water. How are you going to mimic the gravity of the moon?
So we have to accept that obviously perfectly mimicking it is going to be a challenge. Even when we do training with astronauts in the neutral buoyancy facilities and so forth, the swimming pools and so forth, it's not quite 100% accurate, but it's as good as we get. So there's always going to be a bit of a trade-off for realism. At the lunar facility, we're going to use a specialized bespoke crane system that we're developing, which will basically allow the astronauts to connect into it and be offloaded. Kind of similar to what you'd see like at a theatrical production where you might have a rigging system to give an actor some movement or ability to jump up high and so forth. The only difference is in this case, we're using very specialized technology to control the system. There's not going to be three guys in the background with a rope holding them. It's going to be a lot more sophisticated than that. So this is something we're going to have at Luna in the next year, and it will allow essentially two astronauts to walk around inside the entirety of the facility, simulating this 1/6 gravity load using this gravity offloading crane system.
Presumably, you could also calibrate that to recreate Mars if you needed to.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're kind of focusing on the moon at the moment, but we have a view to the Mars in the
we're
future.
We're working on the moon, Jonathan. We're working on the moon.
It's in our mind.
Okay, very cool. So you're recreating the dust, and we know that dust can be a problem for landing, for visibility, for just keeping moving joints of machines working. Right. You've got this microgravity sort of simulation using bouncy wires. And you've also done the lighting. Are there other elements that make it very moon-like? And what is the benefit of making it this realistic? What are the gains?
So I think when we combine all those capabilities together, we do get something that's very representative for what we're looking to use. Obviously, we're not going to have a perfect representation. We're not going to have the vacuum and so forth. We're pretty happy with what we have here for what we're going to use it for, which is predominantly training. The other kind of unique capabilities that we're going to have in this facility is we have a separate kind of annex area, which we call the Dusty Lab. In this particular room, we have a particularly aggressive dust material. So it's an even smaller, fine fraction percentage of the dust material that you find on the moon. And this is something else that we also offer as the facility. So if you really want to do accelerated dust testing, this would be a place where you can put your equipment in there. We can agitate the dust and it will infiltrate and essentially damage and erode your machinery quite quickly, we hope. So it's not just for the training of the astronauts, but we can also do equipment and material testing in this facility as well.
Yeah, I've been to Burning Man a few times, and I know what being immersed in a complete dust storm environment where dust is everywhere and gets everywhere, I know what it can be like just for a couple of days.
Right.
And I guess when we think about the Apollo missions, it really was just, a couple of days on the moon's surface. Expecting people to live and work there for some time, you really have to figure out this dust problem. Is the dust problem the biggest issue for making things work on the moon?
It's definitely one of the biggest issues. And we've studied quite intently the after-action reports from Apollo astronauts. And they nearly uniformly identify dust as one of the biggest hindrances and challenges for exploration. So one good example that I always like to point out was the actual Apollo 12 missions, where the astronauts, when they were conducting their EVA, they put on their suit, they do pressure checks of the suit. And when they first do the pressure check, the suit's working fine. They step out on the surface, they come back in. Next day, they try again, they repressurize the suit. They see that the quality of the pressure seals has degraded. And this is actually quite a noticeable effect. By the second day, the seals were becoming really difficult to pressurize. It's probably by a good chance that they didn't do a third or fourth day, because there's a realistic chance they may not have been able to achieve the required pressurization of the suit to actually exit the vehicle. And this is all due to the dust essentially coming in with the suits when they were doing the EVA, infiltrating the mechanisms and the sealing mechanisms of the suits and degrading
them over
time.
That's insane in such a short period of time that it would essentially make the seals useless on a spacesuit.
Yeah, and that's it's not even like a hyperbole. It's written down. You can actually see the degradation as a function of time. So it's something that people say, oh yeah, we were at the moon for 2 days. I would have questioned if they could have succeeded for 3 or 4 days. And now we're talking about missions with Artemis that are going to be 8 days to 42 days, perhaps, or even longer, maybe in the future.
Wow.
So this becomes a real challenge for us. We really need to take this challenge seriously. And this facility, we hope, is something we can use to test our protocols for cleaning, test new designs to withstand this dust infiltration, and really give us confidence that the systems we bring there will be able to withstand that environment,
Yeah. I mean, we always talk, a lot of the time in this program, we go, it's been so long since we've been on the moon. Why is it taking so long? And I guess this is something that really... if we want to do anything more than just visit it and stick a flag on the surface like we did back in the 60s and 70s, there's a really big hill to climb here. What about testing drilling equipment or testing rovers and landers and all that sort of stuff? Do you get to see the latest prototypes for moon landers there? Is that the plan? Who's going to test there?
Yeah, exactly. So this is also another kind of use case for the facility. Because it's such a large volume of material there, we can actually now do things like excavation. We can do things like drilling and sampling and do it in a representative environment. So a lot of the mission scenarios in the future, at least initial ones, are going to be science exploration. They're going to be astronauts conducting geological surveys, collecting rocks, taking samples, taking core samples, which involves drilling. We can now train this at this facility as well. But also in the future, with more future phases of moon exploration, we're looking into doing things like construction on the moon. How do you do civil engineering on top of sand? You know, this is a real interesting question. And now this facility allows us to conduct experiments and conduct technical studies on how we can actually, you know, mobilize and excavate the material that's there. How can we use it, perhaps, to support missions in the moon? What resources can we get out of it? How can we process them? And how can we do? And we can do this all now in a representative environment, which is a really important thing for giving us confidence in this these technologies. Yeah.
Amazing. Two final questions. The first is, are there any plans to test it out as a habitat and have people stay there, like there have been previous missions for NASA and ESA over the years, to live in this environment that feels very moon-like?
Yeah, so we're actually building a small annex to the main hall. It's basically a small, almost container-shaped habitat module that plugs into the side of the building. And it allowed the astronauts to basically conduct the kind of EVA from this habitat module onto the lunar surface. Mm. Now, the module itself is not going to be representative of a actual habitat. We're using we call it an operational analog because it allows us to conduct operational tests. It allows us to have the astronauts stay there for a period of time, but it's not the shape or form of what we'd actually expect a real habitat to look like. But this is sufficient for us at the moment. The reason why we're doing it this way is because the ambiguity around what future habitats might look like is so great, we can't really converge on a design just now. So we're going to accept a level of ambiguity, but still have some key features, things like airlocks, things like the ability to have astronauts stay in this habitat for periods of time. In anticipation of having more information in the future of what a habitat would look like. So this is another feature that we're going to have at the facility. So I wouldn't call it a fully representative habitat, but more of an operational testing habitat, you know.
Very cool. And final question, is it likely that we might see some Hollywood films set there, or is it just not set up for recreating the moon for film?
So we actually had the Luna inauguration day about 3 weeks ago, and we had a really nice inauguration event. We had a lot of theatricality around the event. We had two of our astronauts conducting EVAs in spacesuits. We had the light system operational. We had the lander being lowered from the roof on the crane. It was all done for the major stakeholders and the local government people who supported the project. And it went very well. And at one point, we kind of looked around and goes like, wow, this is actually an impressive theatrical production, you know. We're probably not going to be giving the facility over for use for movies and so forth. But the resolution and the quality of what you can do there for these kind of for public relations and for outreach is also quite strong.
Yeah, you could recreate the moon landing.
We
and
could
make it for real this time.
Make it for real this time. None of this none of this fake stuff, you know.
Yeah, so, this fake stuff, like really good quality fake stuff.
Exactly.
listen, it's been wonderful to speak to you, and it's great to know that there is an Irishman working at the Astronaut Centre at the European Space Agency. Thank you so much for joining us, Aidan Cowley.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Take care.
All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week's episode. We were talking about evolution and the gaps in between, and that there's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to evolution. We spoke to Simon Conway Morris about it. Jim Andrade, who I think was probably half listening, said, Jonathan, if he says evaluation, I presume he means evolution. If evolution is true, why no half monkey and man and so on? Did someone switch off the light? I don't know. I don't get that, Jim. There are bits in between us and our common ancestor of apes that, roamed the Earth. There's lots of those in very common missing links in the fossil record. And I don't know how the whole missing link took wind, probably because we didn't have as good of a picture of it 100 years ago. But anyway, it's pretty well established now. You can actually just Google that. We were talking about male contraception as well with Logan Nichols, who had some really interesting facts for us about where the male contraceptive world is going to. And he was saying that one of the solutions involves a man rubbing gel into his shoulders for 3 months daily. And that would give you the contraceptive you require, which I think is an interesting one. Ian from Dublin says, ain't no woman going to trust that a man has been rubbing gel into his shoulders for 3 months. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's enough for the man to understand that he is infertile at that moment. But yeah, it's a good question. I don't know if I would trust anyone to do that. It's a very difficult thing to adhere to, I would have thought. Someone else says, you make sperm sound like sea monkeys, just mix them with water. I apologize for that. Although they're not miles off sea monkeys, are they? They swim around in the water and eventually grow to be something bigger. I mean, there's a lot of analogies there when you think about it. And that's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Rory Galvin, and Hugo Da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more on Tuesday in your podcast feed for Future Proof. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.